Hi, I'm Dick Daso, the Executive Director for the Air Force Historical Foundation. For the past 2 years, we've hosted book club and war stories events. The book club, hosted by Pepe Soto and his technical team, examined individuals and events, from Jimmy Doolittle and Hap Arnold to events of the Vietnam War. War Stories, hosted by Matt Jolly, focused on the American exit from Vietnam some 50 years ago. The Foundation is pleased to announce that it will release these interviews as podcasts through the rest of 2024. We hope that you enjoy the breadth and depth of coverage, and stay tuned for more from the AFHF. Enjoy this episode. Like, subscribe, and pass the links along to your cohort.
Good evening and welcome to our first session of the year of the Air Force War Foundation Book Club. We're going to cover the book Linebacker by Colonel Carl Eshman about the linebacker operation in Vietnam. This year we've covered the Vietnam War in all of our books this year, and I'd like to introduce the CEO of the Air Force Foundation, General Mike Holmes. Over to you, Mobile.
Hi, thanks, Pepe. I'm the chairman of the board of the Air Force Historical Foundation. Our president, Jonna Doolittle Hops, I think, is also with us and will join. Our executive director, Dick Daso, is here, and several of our staff. As always, Pepe, I want to start out by thanking you and the team that work the tech magic to make this happen. I also want to thank you for the research you do that gives us our authors and prepares us for these things. So thanks very much. I know you're even signing in from a hotel room on the road here. So thanks. We appreciate it. As Pepe said, last year was our inaugural book club year. I thank you for joining us, and we're glad that you're back with us this year. This year, in addition to focusing our book club on Vietnam and an anniversary of the end of the conflict, we'll also begin a new project we call War Stories that we'll do in the alternate months. So we'll have book club in February, April. Those months, we'll have war stories and the odd months in between. We have a great lineup with a professional media host to work through those. We'll start off with Chuck DeBellevue as our first guest to talk about some of his air combat experiences. And we'll follow that out through the course of the year. And then we'll also be part of a symposium that will look back on the anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam and the role that air power played in it over the course of the year. The leadership in the squadrons that I showed up in, and guys in my generation that showed up in squadrons in 1983 and 1984, the top three in our squadrons were, of course, all veterans of the war, the air war over Vietnam. Many of them veterans of the linebacker campaigns. And they carried the lessons of those campaigns really closely with them. It was certainly important to them. There were things that were done right that they wanted to make sure we continued to do right. There were things they thought were done wrong. They took those personally and wanted to make sure, they were part of an Air Force that had addressed those challenges. And the only way we can continue to do that is to look back and evaluate the true stories of what happened. So, Carl, we're in your debt. Thank you for putting the time together that turned into this book. And Pepe, would you please introduce our speaker?
Well, Carl Eshman is actually a personal friend of mine. I've known Carl since I was in high school. He was my teammate. But he's a graduate of Texas A&M. He's an Aggie, class 71. ROTC, his first year was a lieutenant, was in Vietnam, doing both linebacker 1 and 2 operations. He's a million soldiers for F-4E Phantom 2s. So he has firsthand knowledge of being there on site. His career maintenance officer was PIM for the J-Stars, was a B-52 guy, B-1 maintenance guy, retired as a full colonel, going through various war colleges, then had a great life as a contractor here working on various weapons systems at the weapons lab here in Fort Walton Beach. Without further ado, Colonel Carl Eshman. Over to you, Carl. Carl, on mute.
He's still on mute.
Okay.
There you go. Now?
All right, I'm good. I had to hit a button. So yeah, I was 22 years old, brand new second lieutenant. I never thought I'd end up in the war, my first assignment. And I was a OIC for the 34th TAC Fighter Squadron F4Es. So to start the story, I'm like Pepe said, I want to give about a 15, 20 minute summary before we get into questions and answers, because even people who were assigned here 50 years ago forget some of the things that led up to this and the execution thereof. So let me take you back to 1972, early 1972, February, March timeframe, whatever. It had been 3.5 years since the Rolling Thunder air campaign had stopped, when President Johnson stopped the bombing of North Vietnam after the incidents from the Tet Offensive, and he lost pretty much all interest in the war at that point. When President Nixon was elected, he was trying to find a way to find a good way with honor to get out of Vietnam. So he had started this program called Vietnamization, which is another way of saying we sent plenty of advisors, logistics support, training, fuel, ammunition, weapon systems, spare parts, all that stuff to bring the South Vietnamese up to par so they could defend themselves. Sometime around February or March, we were down to 25,000 U.S. military people left in country, and they were leaving every day. And if you recall, a few years before that, we had up to 500,000 military people in that war. So that was quite a difference. And things were actually going pretty well with training up the Vietnamese and getting them ready. Well, the North Vietnamese knew that if they were going to invade the South, they had to do it quick before the Vietnamese got too proficient and were independent from the U.S. in terms of defending themselves. So during the monsoon season, in the March timeframe, over Easter, the North Vietnamese launched an invasion of 13 divisions into the north, the central, and the southern parts of South Vietnam. Their thousands of troops and conventional tanks and the like were taking one province after another, and the South Vietnamese troops were in total retreat at that point. And there was only one thing that could save them, that would be air power, because their air power wasn't nearly up to the task. At the time, we had moved all our Air Force assets and TAC Air assets out of country into Thailand. And we only had 250 left. All four Navy carriers had left already. We were down to just a handful of B-52s, mostly in Guam. But right away, Nixon said he was going to find a way to make the turnaround. So he gave the Joint Chief of Staff the job of saying, go save the South Vietnamese Army before the whole country falls. So with our 250 TAC Air assets and B-52s, you have to realize that up to that point, the North Vietnamese armies were always hidden in the valleys, the mountains, on the trail. They were never in large units, but now they're fighting a conventional war with the South Vietnamese, and they're all out in the open. And what's that mean for air power? When you got that many troops in the open, and the B-52 cells are coming after them, one after another, arc lighting them, which meant the D model carried 108 bombs. They flew in cells of three, and they could destroy in a kill box everything from 1.2 miles in length to about a half mile wide, and everything in that box would die. And we were killing these guys by the thousands. But we needed more than just to provide air support. One thing that happened was within two weeks, we more than doubled TAC Air Forces in Thailand. We had turned the carriers around. The Navy was back in the South China Sea again. And we had brought a lot more B-52s to the fight. So within 2 weeks, it was pretty much a slaughter for these guys. And so Nixon realized, and his joint chief said, close air support alone wasn't going to do it. There was going to have to be a major interdiction campaign to stem the flow of the supplies and forces and troops from the north to the south. So hence, we were going to have a combined interdiction and close air support to handle this threat. So Nixon also ordered the ports to be mined, in addition to this massive interdiction effort, and all the POL, all the bridges, railroad and road bridges, the huge warehouses and logistics infrastructure, all that was going to be targeted. It took us a while to build the force up, but on 10th of May, 6 weeks after the invasion, we embarked on the first major guerrilla raid, Linebacker One, and we went against the Dover Bridge and the Hanoi Railroad Yards with 117 airplanes, all TAC Air. It's funny, in this part of the war, the B-52s are doing tactical missions in the south, not bombing, strategic bombing, and the fighters are doing the strategic mission of bombing targets up north. So 117 airplanes, and every day from that point all the way through October, that's about the size of the force we threw against the North Vietnamese every single day going after these targets. Now, what were we up against? The North Vietnamese air defenses at the time were the most highly dense defenses on the planet. They had over 200 long-range ground radars, GCI. They had 204 MiGs, MiG 15, 17, 19s, and 21s. They had over 2,000 SA-2 surface-to-air missiles and over 4,000 AAA guns with 23 to 100 millimeter in size, which could reach up and touch. So what this required, and most of our targets were in Route Pack 6, and Route Path 6A being the Hanoi area and 6B being the Haiphong area, that was the highest dense environment, but it also held the most valuable targets, especially in terms of their distribution and supply and railroads. So to go against this threat, the primary strikers were A-7s and F-4s for the Air Force and A-6s for the Navy. It required a strike support ratio of about 1-4. So for every strike airplane, you needed 4 support airplanes, whether it's Wild Weasels, Hunter Killers, EB-66 Jammers, EC-121s, and all the other, and chaff bombers for ingress and egress chaff corridors. So it required a lot of assets to go up against the SAMs, the MiGs, as well as the guns. But the guns were kind of secondary as opposed to the MiGs and the SAMs. So that required an awful lot of effort. But we learned how to do that rather well. And by the time Linebacker One had finished in, was finishing up in October, it was, we had pretty much destroyed a lot of their warehousing. We destroyed every single bridge. We wiped out their whole POL, all their fuel farms. We took down 60% of their power grid. And worse than that, interdicting the trail along the way, the North Vietnamese Army was getting less than 20% of the weaponry and the supplies and food and reinforcements that they needed to keep sustained combat with the South. So they started falling back on every single front in the South. Once the North Vietnamese realized this, as they always did in the past, they always offered to go back to the peace talks, and we would always succumb to that. We always got tricked into going along with that, and we stopped on October 23rd. We stopped Linebacker One and agreed to go back to the talks. And that's when Secretary of State Kissinger said, peace is at hand, because he thought for sure they were going to sign the agreement. Well, all the North Vietnamese did was buy themselves time to rebuild, to basically wait for the monsoon season to go from south to north, where they thought we couldn't touch them then, because they never in their right mind thought we'd ever send the B-52s up north. In any case, they wanted a ceasefire. They got it. For 2 months, they rebuilt. And then right when they thought they had us, on the 13th of December, the North Vietnamese announced that they were walking out of the peace talks. Well, President Nixon was incensed. He was infuriated on this. And he told the chief of staff, Admiral Moore, I want you to launch a major campaign And I want to bring these people to their knees and bring them back to the table. And in other words, re-motivate them to come back. So he ordered a 24-hour massive bombing campaign, North Vietnam, which was the first time we had done this in the war, because before we mostly flew at day missions. Now we're going to fly day and night. And basically the plan was going to be one wave of attack air forces by day and three waves of B-52 bombers coming from Guam and Utapau in Thailand at 2 a.m. or at 8 p.m., midnight, and 4 a.m. every night, and used the massive bombing radar nav, radar bombing capabilities of the B-52s and the Navy A-6s, and the F-111s as well. So at the time, we had about 560 TAC air assets for this in Thailand, and 206 B-52s. We had put a lot of B-52s into the conventional mode. Anderson Air Base was completely massively crowded from one end to the other, and so was Utapau. So the plan was, this was a SAC plan, that there'd be three waves, each wave about 30 to 50 B-52s spaced 4 hours apart. They would ingress from northwest sector of North Vietnam and head southeast against target sets around the Hanoi area, with some targets in Haiphong and some other targets being airfields and whatnot. But the problem with having three waves of 52s and one wave of attack air meant that, if you remember earlier, I said you need a ratio of 1-4 support to be able to adequately handle the North Vietnamese defense. Well, we only had 39 TAC air support assets for each of those B-52 waves, because they were spread up across four different waves in 24 hours. So, and even worse than that, each 52 cell was quiet time only, which meant no IFF, no talk between aircraft. They had a tailwind of 100 miles per hour from the northwest, which was going to be a problem, because the SAC plan was, as soon as there was no TTR target tracking radar maneuvers allowed, straight all the way through the IP to drop. And then right after drop, over the most densest SAM battery area, they would turn, do a post-target turn to the west, right into the tailwind. And of course, at 60 degree bank, almost a 90 degree turn, there was going to be an issue with the cell integrity of the electronic countermeasures, the all 22s that protected the buffs. As long as they were flying in a decent formation, straight and narrow, which couldn't pick individual bombers, but the moment you did a post target turn, you could individually be seen. And worse than that, the ECM you were spitting out could end up home on jam from the SA-2s. So this was not a good plan. That's the thing that they wanted to do. And worse than that, the 100 mile per hour winds blew away all the chaff corridors that were laid 15 minutes before the buffs were supposed to show up. And even worse than that was our TAC air units did not know precisely where the buff formations were. They only had time on target. They did not have specific routes going in, so they kind of had to guess where the buffs that they were supporting were going to be, like the weasels lining up to go after the threat and this sort of thing. So they did their best guess, and obviously after the first few attacks, there were so many SAMs being fired, the sky was lit up and they could actually see the B-52 formation. The F-111s went in and did some airfield suppression also before that. North Vietnamese were not known for great night flying techniques, but you have to realize also that the North Vietnamese Air Force was also composed with Russian and Polish and Czechoslovakian and other nations that were assisting them, as well as assisting the SAM crews. So the outcome was that the first day, we lost three B-52s. And SAC assumed that was an okay percent for their purposes. Second day, we didn't lose any, and it validated that they were doing the right thing. Well, the second day, they didn't lose anything because the second day, they flew exactly the same stereotype routes against same targets, same altitude, same post-target turns. And the North Vietnamese were not stupid. So second day, they were resetting up their SAM batteries and their MiGs for GCI control to go thinking we would certainly never do that on day three. Well, that's exactly what we did on day three. We did exactly same targets, same altitude, same routes, and we lost six B-52s. So we lost nine B-52s in the first 3 days, 620 SAM missiles fired at them. And they weren't shooting any attack air assets. They were saving all their bullets for the bombs. So it was obvious, but with everybody, that they needed a new plan. This was not going to work. So they went into what was called stage two, days 4 through 7. Interim effort. Nothing flew out of Guam for that period of time. They all came from Utapau. And it was 30 B-52s only attacking the periphery. During the daytime, TAC Air was still doing the same targeting. But what that did was only one wave of B-52s that doubled up to 60 to 70 support aircraft, which now your ratio is getting a bit better to protect the bomber. And they did new chaff delivery techniques instead of going ingress and egress corridors. They did wide area chaff drops so that the wind was no longer a factor. They also brought other Weasel airplanes from other services to come assist with that. And then on top of that, what we had learned in the first 3 days, the North Vietnamese SAM sites were using an I-band normally associated with guns that they were directing their SA-2s with. And we had, at the time, we had no missiles or not enough missiles to cope with that problem. We had to wait a day or a few days until we could get new anti-radiation missiles in theater. In any case, TAC Air kept up the pressure. We ended up with a 36-hour Christmas break, not because it was Christmas, but because we had flown continuously since day one, and our airplanes were, I was signing so many airplanes off as a maintenance officer with hold fly write-ups that normally I would ground the airplane with, but we did press on with it and sent them out anyway. And the buffs are doing the same thing. So we needed some downtime, and we got it. Days three, right after Christmas, days 8 through 11, they totally changed the plan. They were going to send 120 B-52s within a 15-minute period from different axes, different azimuth, different altitudes against a number of targets, primarily over Hanoi. And we had over 100 to 120 support aircraft up there keeping the threat off of them. But even then, we still lost four more B-52s during that period. But by day 10, we had found through the Firebee reconnaissance drones that were launched from 130s into North Vietnam, we had tracked where all the North Vietnamese units were getting their resupply of their SA-2s. Because when an SA-2 came in, it came in as a kit, and it had to go to a facility where they put it together, checked it out, and all that sort of thing. And then they sent them out SAM sites, and we tracked down where that facility was, which was just north of Phu Quyen Airfield, north of Hanoi. And the B-52s went in there and just wiped the whole place out, along with the secondary facilities, which essentially meant we cut off any resupply of SA-2s to the sites. And at the same time, we had so many mid-cap F-4s in the air that they were actually turning on their landing lights and beacon anti-collision lights, trying to lure what few MiGs were up to come get them, because there were so many guys ready to take them out. So we had all but destroyed the air defenses of North Vietnam by day 10, and we had total air superiority. But at that point, we had also run out of targets, because we had killed essentially all 59 of the targets assigned, and all we were doing was just spreading the wreckage out a bit more. Well, the North Vietnamese, as you might understand, when you have 120 B-52s over your head in a 15-minute period, that had to be a pretty noisy night every night during that time frame. And the North Vietnamese realized the jig was up. So they motioned that they wanted to return to the peace table. And on the 29th of December, on day 11, we quit linebacker two. We had reached our objective of getting them back to the table. We had done 1,364 strike sorties, 724 B-52 missions. We had lost 27 aircraft, and 15 of them were B-52s, and 11 TAC Air, and we lost 41 aircrew in the process. But the BDA, as a process, was complete destruction of all the railroads, the rail yards, the warehouse distribution, all the SAM systems were nullified, and their resist was crushed. So the lesson to that is something we, if you recall, when we started the war in Iraq, you know, we went with total destruction of their air defenses right at the outcome of the battle, which is what we should have done in this case, but we didn't. We kind of got into it later. But in the end, we had a ceasefire agreement that was signed on the 23rd of January, and within 60 days, our POWs were on the way home. Now, this was after 8 years of war, 8 years of the air war. We had lost up to that point 3,734 fixed wing airplanes and over 7,000 helicopters. If you can imagine today's force structure losing that many, I can't imagine. But it took over a long time to do that, and people really didn't notice it every day. Certainly people in America had no idea of the extent that our air crews and soldiers, what they were going through in that war. Anyway, that's the summary. That's the quick summary. I don't know if I busted it or not, but I thought I'd just start that so that it would give some place to start from for questions.
Well, thanks. That was a great wrap-up, Carl, of the whole your whole book. I mean, your book is fascinating. And your book started as an ACSC paper, correct?
Yes.
So why did you pick linebacker for your paper to begin with? Because your experience in Vietnam, or just that was at that time in school something important to study about?
No, actually, when I was picked to go Air Command staff, I knew that we had to write a paper while we were there for a year, right? So, and I wasn't quite set on my subject yet until about a month before we moved to Montgomery. My wife, Charlotte, and I went out to dinner, and we had this babysitter. And she had, when we came back and paid her off, I noticed she was studying a history book, world history. And I asked her, can I look at your book? She said, sure. And of course, I went right to Vietnam. And the first thing I read about linebacker was how the President Nixon, after the invasion, decided he was going to repay North Vietnam by saturation bombing the cities of Hanoi and Haiphong and others, causing thousands upon thousands of civilian casualties. Well, none of that happened. This is just made up stuff that shows up in the history books, and you know, everybody's a war criminal in Vietnam, right? That's what they're portraying Nixon as. But nothing of the sort happened. In fact, even after 11 days over Hanoi and linebacker two, even the mayor said that the total death toll was a little over 1,300, but that doesn't include people that were in the target area that were legitimate targets. Most of the civilian casualties were killed by some of the B-52s crashing downtown, or damaged to the point where the bomb train was off center from where they were supposed to hit. Total accidents, but it still was minimal casualties. So I decided right then and there, what I was going to write about was what really happened in linebacker one and two, or during my year in Southeast Asia. And I decided I wasn't going to editorialize or make up my own stories or anything like that. I was going to go to Simpson Library and take it just the way it was documented, stick to the facts. And I was lucky enough that they had just declassified all the documents on linebacker, except for Strategic Air Command, that didn't like these ugly baby stories. They certainly didn't like my book when it first came out because it made them look like buffoons, which in many cases they were. So in any case, I decided to write. The paper requirement was 25 pages. I wrote 234. My advisor said I was absolutely nuts. We didn't have PowerPoint back then, so I had to do all the drawings by hand, you know, all the drawings in the book and everything, you know, by gluing B-52s on a sheet and that sort of thing. And my wife, Charlotte, typed the papers because we didn't have computers back then. So remember, this is 84. So that's why I wrote it. Now, I ended up winning every award at Air Command staff at the end of the year for writing this paper the way it did. I got lots of cool stuff, lots of different awards. But the only comment that the commander, the general in charge of ACS, he gave me was, I don't understand how a non-rated guy like you could even write a book about operations in air combat. And it's like, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, all your guys like Weasels and all that, they're writing 25-page papers, how to make the most out of a ditty move and stuff like this. And it's like, I actually took the time to go to the library and make hundreds and hundreds of copies of all those declassified documents and put them together and make the story out of it. Now, of course, it was relegated to the dust bins in Air University until some guy named Dan Craig, he was an Army guy, wrote books on Vietnam infantry, but his son was in Air Force ROTC, and he ordered a DTEC copy of my paper and for his ROTC study on Vietnam, and he took it right to his publisher because he wrote lots of books under a guy named Owen Bach and Valentine Ivy Books out of Random House, and they called me and said, we'd like you to submit a manuscript cleaned up a bit because the way you write for the Air Force isn't the way you write for the general public. So I said, I'm on the Joint Stars program. I got no time for this. They said, look, we'll give you this big advance and we won't even give you a date. When you're ready, call us and we'll publish this thing. And so 9 months later, I called him and said, I'm ready. That's how I ended up getting published.
Ken, want to bring up Scott's question?
What's that?
Hi there. Yes, sir. I enjoyed your presentation. I'm one of the younger people here. I remember only Vietnam where I was watching the tube and home with my parents, 6 o'clock. If my question is very simple, if LBJ had done what Nixon done during that month or so years earlier, how long would the air war would have lasted? How long would they have? Or what other targets, if besides just Hanoi or Haiphong, would they have targeted? No, that's a what if, I grant you, but just, you know, would have, like Goldwater said during, you know, his election, the Vietnam War will end in 2 weeks or something like that.
Well, that's good. It's a good question, and it's one we used to ask ourselves all the time. And I did look stuff up on that. And the problem is LBJ did not unleash his military commanders to plan targets and devise tactics. He always bragged that you can't hit an outhouse anywhere in North Vietnam without my approval and permission. And so we had some really strict rules of engagement during Rolling Thunder, for example. And quite frankly, if Nixon would have been president back then, or practically anybody would have been president, we let the North Vietnamese from day one build up their SAM units, build up their radars, you know, get their pilots trained up and whatnot, and to become a professional air defense system. And we were already at war with these guys. So it's like, why didn't we just stop it right then? We could have done something a lot less than linebacker two to not even let this get started the way it did. We let these guys over the years build the most integrated air defense system that any air crew up to that point had to face. And it didn't have to happen that way, but it did happen that way. And then Nixon, when he gave approvals for linebacker one and two, he eliminated all the former sanctuary areas that Johnson had put. Under Johnson, you couldn't hit within a 10-mile circle anywhere in Hanoi, Haiphong. You were not allowed to hit the power centers. You were not allowed to hit anything that was near a dike, a dam dike system. So what did they do? They put all the SA-2 sites all over the dike system, right? You couldn't hit anything 40 miles away from China because at the time, some of you may recall this, Nixon was trying to establish ties with China. Remember the ping pong politics they were playing and whatnot. He was trying to get them to break out and establish normal relationships. So, but he eliminated all those sanctuaries. And not only that, but during the linebacker days, we had this thing called the laser guided bomb technology, which we didn't have back in Rolling Thunder, which was a very precise system that could take out a power unit in a downtown area and never harm one single civilian. So that changed a lot of things for us in terms of targeting and whatnot. But yes, had we done this a lot earlier, first of all, not to let it grow that large to become such a professional air defense unit or a system, or to tackle it early, a lot of things would have been different in our history.
Okay, General Holmes, do you have a question?
Thanks. And Carl, you know, you said you set out to write this thing without, the emotion and the politics, and I think you did a great job. And then I'm also really impressed with the way you brought in the first person accounts out of the logs and out of the histories to make it breathe, to make it, real to people that are reading it, and a nice mix of that. And we look at this war between a fully developed air defense system that included, as you described, SAM's AAA aircraft, the C-2 to make it work, electronic combat resources, and then between a fully functional Air Force that could do all the missions you expect an Air Force to do. There's a lot of cat and mouse over the whole war and certainly over the linebacker campaign. That story you tell about the I-band radars is one of my favorite ones, but what do you think about that part of it, the changes that both sides made in tactics during the course of the campaign, and which ones were the most important ones?
Well, every single day, again, because we didn't have, like we're doing a Zoom tonight, this would have been a great thing for us to have had in Thailand between TAC Air and SAC units and Navy and Marines. We didn't have any of that stuff. We flew everything by paper with T-39s. Every day in Yuban, in 7th Air Force, every single day we had what was called a linebacker summary conference. And that meant weasels and EB-66s, AWACS, you name it, everybody and their brother all flew for a face-on meeting every single day to talk through what happened today, what did we do wrong, and what can we do to fix it. Of course, it was not going to fix the next day because that frag was already out, but it was going to be the day after. I'm sure the North Vietnamese had a very similar process like this. Every time we changed tactics, for example, the weasels used this anti-radiation missile, the Shrike, the AGM-45, which was a good missile, but you needed the radar to be on for that to work. We also had a AGM-78, which is standard arm, which was a huge missile, you know, much like you see launched off of ships these days. But it was a real, it was heavy, it caused a lot of drag. And there were days when you didn't know what that missile was gonna do, because once you launched it, it could go up, it could go left, it could go right, it could go into your F-4 wingman, it could do all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, at one point it took out the French embassy downtown Hanoi. So, but in any case, we had these AGM-45s, and the North Vietnamese, a lot of times the weasels would do shots without knowing where a site was, and they would do a preemptive shot just to keep the radar from coming on. The intent was not to kill the radar every time as much to not allow them to zing in on our aircraft and have an operable fire control working for them the whole time. There was a time when they brought this launcher in. It was a dual launcher for the AGM-45, which meant you could carry four AGM-45s as opposed to two, but you probably couldn't fly the standard arm with it, if I recall. But it caused a lot of drag too. But we did that a couple of times, and the North Vietnamese would count. He fired 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. He's out. He's finished. Well, they weren't finished because they still had those extra rounds on board. So we kept those guys guessing. How many weapons did the weasels actually have on that day, right? So, and you're right, there was cat and mouse the whole time. There was an instance, there was this SAMSI, VN549, which is very close to where Radio Hanoi was. We always suspected that the Russians were actually manning that site. They had shot down at least four or five B-52s at that point. And one of the weasels had, they had zeroed in on the site, but it was a cloudy day. So the F-4Es that were playing killer, they carried CBUs that they would do the cleanup on the SAM site once the site was marked by the anti-radiation missiles hitting the radar van. But the F-4s couldn't see it. They couldn't attack the site. So the weasel just simply, and it's in my book, I'm sure you remember that part, where he zeroed in and fired his AGM-45 with no anything, like a FAC-01 would fire his target rocket, and he hit the site. And then at that point, the F-4s could see where the site was. But there's stuff I got that happened like that every single day. And the lessons learned, I know one time Pepe asked me, well, how is it, you know, what did we learn out of linebacker one that helped with linebacker two protecting your buffs? Well, for one thing, we had learned an awful lot of lessons learned about fighting the North Vietnamese air defense, none of which was understood by Strategic Air Command at that point. You know, they thought they had it knocked with their ECM and their radios off and all that. They thought, oh, well, no problem. If we could get through Russian air defense, we ought to be able to get through these guys. Well, not so. So the lessons that eventually ended up saving them was that they realized they needed TAC air support with a really good ratio, you know, not less than 1-to-1 like we started out with, because you cannot suppress the enemy air defenses without adequate resources to start that game out. And by the end of linebacker, by the end of two, we had learned that really well. And we had also learned it because in between, when the North, October 23rd to December, the B-52s had been slowly but surely working their way up from the southern part of North Vietnam into target areas that had a lot more SAM sites. And it came to the realization they were going to need the weasels, they were going to need the F-4s, they're going to need MIG-CAPs because there were MIGs in that area as well. And that started this understanding that the TAC air support integrated was, and by the way, nobody had written anything. There was no book to go to on this when we did linebacker. This was all learned in process.
Wow. Hey, Dick, you have a question? Dick Dazzo?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and read his out for the group. So he was asking, sir, if you can draw any lessons from Vietnam and apply them to the situation in Ukraine and the U.S. involvement there.
Well, the lessons are always the same. It's only the equipment that changes. There's no difference I can see in a lot of the things. I'm amazed that the Ukrainians have survived, their Air Force has survived at all, along with their defenses, because it makes it obvious to me that the Russians are totally incompetent. Because my opinion is, within day two, if the Ukrainians would have been fighting us, we would have wiped them out by day two. I'm convinced of it. But that's not what happened. I'm glad it didn't happen. But the lessons are the same. You got to have your stuff together. You got to have your targeting process together. You got to have your integration of your forces together. One of the biggest problems we had in Vietnam was there was no central air boss that was in control of all the air assets. We fixed that. We fixed that big time with air operation centers, with one air boss in basically in control of all air assets within theater. And the reason is, if you go back to Vietnam, we had this thing called a route back system. It started at one, was way south next to South Vietnam, and it went all the way up to six as you went north. Most of those coastal areas were controlled by the Navy, and the Air Force controlled the two upper ones, route back six and five. But there was no integration or coordination between us and the Navy and the Marines, and certainly not SAC at the beginning, which meant we were probably not prioritizing our targets correctly for an overall effort against the threat. Now, with the Ukrainians, this is the difference between the Ukrainians and the Russians. They're fighting for their lives in Ukraine. Their people are motivated. They've got good equipment and their tactics and their leadership, as opposed to the Russians, who have tons more equipment, tons more tanks, tons more airplanes, but they're not properly utilizing them, and they're getting slaughtered by these guys because of that. So again, a lot of the lessons are the same. It's just the people change and the equipment changes, but how you cope with them is it. By the way, there's a lot I didn't put in my book for that reason, because I knew that all over the planet, people were going to be reading this book, and there was still stuff that was still used in present day tactics and strategic policy and all that I did not include, because I didn't want everybody on this planet knowing everything that we do.
Linda, McMahon, want to ask your question? Are you up?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Pepe. And Carl, thank you for your time tonight. I was just curious, when you talk about how we allow the adversary to rebuild and build stronger, I feel that's what we happened in Southwest Asia. I was just wondering if you had some thoughts you'd like to share on that, because the fall of Saigon sure looked like the fall of Afghanistan to me.
Well, it's more than just those two. I feel like in my, because I worked 50 years in the Air Force, 26 years active, 24 as a contractor. As a contractor, I spent a lot of time in Iraq and LUD and places like that, you know, Qatar and Kuwait. And I looked at what we did to the South Vietnamese. The thing that's always irritated me was we won the battles in Vietnam, but we lost the political will, and the Democratic Congress cut our funds. I remember one of the worst times of my times in Southeast Asia was when the Democrats had voted to cut all funds for military use of our aircraft to help the Cambodians in the Laotians after Vietnam, right? And August 15th, 1973, that's it. Funds cut, we're not allowed to help them anymore. Worse than that, even worse than that was, we reneged our commitments to South Vietnam to resupply them with arms and food and fuel and training. And they cut all those funds off. So there, even as a dumb lieutenant back then, I knew this was gonna go bad. And in 1975, they proved it. Then Iraq happened. I spent 4 years doing counter IED work in Iraq, back and forth. We had wiped out the IED threat. 2006, we were losing 30 people a week. And by 2009, I could drive a truck anywhere in Anbar province and not get killed. because we had taken all these people down with all kinds of technologies that we're still using. And it was working rather well. We were starting to retrain the Iraqis like we were supposed to do with the Vietnamese and supplies and all that. And our president then decided, 2011, we quit and we left. We left within weeks of him saying, leave Iraq. And so look what happened. ISIS came in and we had to start all over again until we had a new president who went back. And then we had to go back and do the same thing all over until we got that country back into some semblance, right? Afghanistan, same story. These people, these Taliban who had taken these provinces down and had were on the open highways with the MRAPs and Humvees and tanks and all this stuff they had captured from the Afghan forces should have never made it to Kabul. We had the ability and the weapons to kill these people by the thousands, and we chose not to. And then we let them corner us in Kabul airport, and there you saw the outcome of that. So yes, I feel like I've lived at least three times in my life seeing the same story played over and over.
Daryl, you said anybody have a question, sir? Daryl Wickham? Well, Daryl has a book. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm up now. You ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to ask Carl. I was over there that year. I was a forwarder controller, and so this is all, some of this is personal knowledge to me, but just like to ask your assessment during linebacker and then linebacker two rescue efforts. We, of course, had U.S. Air Force Jolly Green squadrons there available. We had the A-1s replaced by A-7s. Of course, we had the Navy guys out on the boats, did great work for us with HC-7. And of course, in South Vietnam, we had our Army assets who would quickly do rescues for us. And we had Air America in Laos. They did rescues for us too. So I'd like your thoughts, Carl, please, on all that.
Of course, when I was at Karat, the C-130 command post for rescue for CSAR was at Karat. That's where they had them. The A-1Es were up at NKP along with the Jolly Greens. And I was there when the 354th fighter wing with the A-7s came in. At that point in time, in October 72, we were giving all the A-1Es in our inventory to the South Vietnamese, which essentially wiped out our A-1E CSAR force. But amazingly enough, these A-7 guys came in and they picked up on that job without any hesitation. They learned that job almost immediately. The moment they were assigned, they were already doing SAR missions for downed air crews. And I've got nothing but praise for our SAR forces in Southeast Asia. And not only that, not just the SAR forces. When we had an air crew go down anywhere in the area, if we could reach them, we stopped the war. All those airplanes, I said, like 117 going to linebacker one missions, we would quit that and go put every one of those resources to go save this guy out or save this guy we were trying to rescue. That was first priority. Most nations of the world do not understand that concept. Why the United States puts so much emphasis on saving the ones that they can, if possible. So yeah, we did lots of, and some of the stuff I wrote in the book, but there's hundreds of stories of SAR efforts, many of which were successful, some of which were unfortunately unsuccessful. I can remember in one instance, we had on the 17th of September, 72, we lost this Wild Weasel crew out of the 17, and the pilot's name was Captain Tom Zorn, and his backseater was Lieutenant Mike Taros, and they had gone after a target over the north as part of a hunter-killer team, and an SA-2 got them, and they weren't that far from the coast, and they were on fire. So they tried their best to make it to the coast. But at the last minute, explosions, they had to eject, and they were right on the coast, right in the line of fire of all the coastal guns that were located by the North Vietnamese gunners at that point. As they came down into the water, every gun that was there was hosing these guys down. And I'm pretty sure both of them were killed in their chutes before they hit the water. But in the meantime, there's a guy today by the name of Dave Swan. He lives about a block away from me here. He was a CSAR Navy helicopter. They always flew in pairs off the carrier. And he happened to be in the area. And he saw the chutes and he saw the crew coming down. He put his helicopters over the crew members, dropped his swimmers, and they were doing their best pulling the chutes because these guys were sinking. And the swimmers were already reporting that they're dead. We're just trying to retrieve their body. But the gunfire got so intense, he had to leave the area. He left his swimmers there. And he had to leave the area until the remainder of the Wild Weasel team and the killers were providing gun suppression to allow them to come back and pick up their swimmers. But all the time, they're getting hit by all these guns. And fortunately, neither one of them was shot down. But it's guys like that that went out every day and did this kind of stuff that were total heroes. And by the way, nobody in this country knows these stories at all. So yeah, CSAR, high respect, always, if possible, would go and rescue a number of our down air crews.
Wow. All right, sir, we have one more question from the group. It's asking if you have any thoughts about the role General Sullivan may have played in changing B-52 tactics and risking his career to speak out.
So Ray Sullivan, his son, is a good friend of mine. We do a lot of presentations together in the local area. His father is again, one of these heroes in my mind. He was a one star. He was the commander of UDAPAL. If you looked at his chain of command, it actually came through Anderson Air Force Base, down, and I'm not gonna go into names, but his senior officers at Anderson, they were all about making threats to air crews that if you do any maneuvering before you drop your bombs, it's gonna be a court-martial offense, and all this stuff going on. It's like these guys were spreading fear with their air crews to do really stupid things and tactics and formations and timing and all that. Glenn Sullivan is one of those guys that recognized on the very first day that this is not a good plan. And so he started allowing his air crews to do things contrary to the orders from higher headquarters. He allowed his air crews to do some maneuvering tactics to throw the target tracking radars off. He did other things too. And worst on his case, he went around his chain of command and called the SAC commander at Offutt and told him, this is what's happening and it's just outright wrong and we need to change our tactics and we need to change our plan. Of course, those of you who remember Strategic Air Command, for that matter, any command, when you go around your chain of command, that's it for you. You know, that's it. You're never going to get promoted again. In some cases, you would even get court-martialed for disobeying orders, but they didn't do that. But I think Glenn Sullivan, every air crew in his wing looked up to him as a true leader and looking out for them and trying to maintain and keep them alive and do the right thing. In the end, we ended up doing that. In the end, we ended up doing a lot of the stuff that General Sullivan was recommending. But in the end, he also got killed for the effort. So that's my thoughts about General Sullivan.
I got the last question, and sir, it's been awesome, Carl. Thanks for doing this for us. My last question is, what lessons would like our airmen today to take away from reading your book for today's airmen? What would be the key lesson learned from them from your book?
Well, I know the lesson I learned when I did war gaming later at Air War College and Navy War College and whatnot. I always would target the SAM facilities as my very first target, along with the air defenses, and I've won the game every single time. So if you're gonna do something, you do it the way we did Iraq. You go in there and you pound them to death at the very first hours of the war, and you wipe these guys out with sufficient forces to do that, which means you build up your forces, and then you make it your time, and you go after these guys, and you don't allow rules of engagement or as LBJ did, he escalated the war by stages. And every time he did that, it just allowed the enemy to catch up with our tactics. So I'm trying to remember a term we used in the Iraq war about the first night when all the bombs were coming. What was the term we used, Pepe? You remember?
Oh, wow.
Shock and awe.
Shock and awe.
Yes, shock and awe. That's it. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. Most of the other lessons have already been tailored to our current forces, so no recommendation needed there. But I think if you're going to go in against an opponent, you need to do it in a way that you're going to get his attention and understand he's not going to win the final outcome.
Awesome, sir. Well, Carl, thanks. As an old friend for doing this for us, I appreciate it. And I can tell you, it's like a weapons school debrief on a war. It's been pretty awesome hearing all your comments and insights. And hopefully to start some great discussion this year about the Vietnam War. And it's a point also about CSAR being a former SIO for the Joint Combat Rescue Agency. I was kind of surprised that our CSAR package for Kosovo was the same one you guys had for Vietnam. So something's haven't changed. So thanks for your time, Carl. And I know we'll keep in touch. Well, that's tonight's session, everybody. We'll come back in April with the limits of air power, which will discuss the same thing from a different perspective. And we have 6 books this year. And thank you for joining us. General Holmes, any comments from you, sir?
Thank you, Pepe. Thanks again, Carl. You know, Mike, Carl, I want to thank you for the time that went into this. I think it's important for today's airmen to read. One of my takeaways is that air superiority has to be fought for by brave men and women to accomplish it. And if you look back on the time since, we lost more airplanes in the linebacker campaign than we've lost in combat altogether in all of our conflicts since, just in linebacker. And when we think about squaring off with peer adversaries again, we're going to have to fight. It'll be brave men and women that figure out the ways to win. And I'd like all our, young folks in the Air Force to read through this and remember what it looked like. So thanks very much for sharing it.
Thank you. One comment, that book you're holding up, that was a reprint by a British company, and they left out all my drawings, all my pictures, everything. And I took hits for that, and I didn't even know they were going to do that. So if people are going to buy my book, do not buy that one with the F4s. Buy the brown pocketbook, used book sale, go to bookfinder.com or somewhere, buy it for $3, get all the pictures, maps, and everything that goes with it.
Thanks.
Thanks, sir. Have a good Air Force night. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Pepe, you still on?